This is episode 9 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler, and I'm here with Bradley Kuhn.
And here we are.
We're back.
Back, yes. So you're back from something?
Oh, I actually meant that we're back for another episode, but I am actually back in that we're sitting here with my suitcase that I got back today from BASA, which was an excellent conference on mobile phones in Brazil.
Yeah, and it was pretty hackerish, right? It was mostly developers.
It was, yeah.
People who work in the mobile space with free software.
Yeah, it was. It was a really great conference. I think that that the attendance was really great and the talks were as well. It was really fun.
Oh, yeah, I guess I'm technically back, too, because I was at the Poker Source free software poker conference in Las Vegas, which is where I actually uploaded the show from last time.
So. Oh, really?
I didn't realize the actual file uploading happened from there.
Oh, okay.
Of course you did. We were on the phone while I was doing it.
I think you should explain what Poker Source is.
Oh, briefly. It's open source and free software to do online poker, pokersource.info. And it's completely unrelated to any work I do with Solve the Freedom Law Center or Conservancy. So it was vacation I was technically on as far as the SFLC was concerned, but I was at a free software-related conference anyway.
Right.
So there, that's enough of the off-topic discussion.
Well, I guess to get on topic abruptly, I one of the things that we always talk about are the different viewpoints that that are involved in free and open source software. And it's really interesting because, you know, we are coming at it from a public charity perspective. We work at, the Software Freedom Law Center is a legal services organization, and it's basically organized in the public interest.
501c3.
With no members.
Correct.
And the people who we interact with a lot are mostly our clients who are hackers.
And sometimes 501c3 organizations
and sometimes
themselves.
Organizations, yeah, absolutely. And I guess we also sometimes talk to our funders who are a mix of corporations and also individuals and other organizations.
But you're talking about these other types of nonprofits, which are trade associations.
Well, there are a number of different kinds of nonprofit organizations. But our guest today...
That's right, we have a guest. We didn't have a guest in the last episode, and now we have a guest again.
Which is really exciting, and I think
so we should tell them who our guest is.
But I thought that we would have a teaser, you know, we would we would let them be surprised.
But the name of the guest is in the file name they downloaded.
Oh, you're right.
It's on the website, and also if they've looked at the screen of their player.
But maybe they haven't looked at their screen.
I just said
so.
If
don't look at your screen,
Karen. As soon as I said if they've looked at the screen of their player, everybody got out their player and looked at the screen.
Well, humor me.
All right. So you don't know who the guest is yet. Karen is going to introduce the guest, whom you don't know who it is yet, because you haven't looked on the website or the show notes or the file name or the screen of your player. Go ahead. Please.
All right. Fine. Our guest today is Karen Copenhaver, who is a lawyer.
I'm so surprised. I didn't know. So Karen Copenhaver from,
who is a lawyer with the Linux Foundation.
A 501c6
trade association. Which is a 501c6 trade association. And in the next segment in our interview with her, you'll hear a little bit more about about her role in the organization and about trade associations a little bit more. And we're back. And this time, we have with us another Karen. So you're lucky to have two Karens today. We have Karen Copenhaver with us from the Linux Foundation. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so I'll try to be careful about saying Karen so it's clear who I'm talking about. Okay, so for the rest of this interview, if I say Karen, I'm referring to the Karen on the phone, not you. Is that okay?
I think it could be comedy.
Okay. Okay. Well, Karen, on the phone, why don't you start out by just telling us generally how you got involved with open source and free software and where your interest came in?
It was a long time ago. In the middle 90s, when I first came to Boston, and I was working with a company, and this is an ancient memory, so it'll be a little bit of a gloss, but there was a reference platform, and there someone had a library, and it had been licensed under the GPL, not the LGPL, but the GPL, And it was the first time I ever read the document, and I thought, you know, this is crazy. And I kept pushing on the fellow, and you know, saying you got to find a different library. And he kept coming back to me, and you know, through the lawyer, saying no, he really wants to use this library. And finally, we all got on the phone, and he explained. And I thought this is just a perfect explanation. He said this library, this math library, is used by you know mathematicians in universities, you know, all over the world. It's been peer reviewed by you know people who are experts in these fields. We all rely on it. You do not want me to find another library. and it was a very interesting conversation. We had a conversation for a long time about you know about this you know the whole concept, and I went away you know just feeling completely different about the whole subject and began you know reading a lot about it. I'm not a programmer. I wish I was, but I had caught. You know, caught the interest because this was a brilliant man, and it was obviously revered at the company he worked at, and he was a wonderful explainer of the value of peer-reviewed technology and technology that was made available on terms where everyone could benefit from its improvement.
So you started out actually as a lawyer who was encouraging your client to avoid using a free software license.
When I first read it, I said, "Oh, you got to find something." I mean, I looked at it, said, "This is really odd," and it is odd. It is revolutionary, and it became. You know, it wasn't long after that that I was. You know, I was working with a lot of small companies. I was at a firm that worked with portfolio companies, and I had worked at IBM for many years, and I worked very, very closely with the engineers and developers. I enjoyed that. I loved the engineers. And so when I worked with these portfolio companies, I would be talking a lot to the people who were actually doing development. If I got involved in a contract, I knew that the facts were really much more important than the law, you know, understanding what it was that they were trying to build and, you know, what mm-hmm. the actual problems would be regarding getting the work done as opposed to all the boilerplate at the back of the agreement. And so I loved talking to all these developers, and because of that, they would send me things all the time, and I would have a file on these companies, and I would review lots of agreements for them, and they were all using, you know, very, very valuable pieces of open source technology. Then, you know, there'd come a time when I'd be sitting in a room with their executives, and there, you know, there might be a potential for an acquisition or a potential for an important, you know, OEM agreement, and someone would say, you know, do you have any third party code? Do you have any third party technology? And the executives would say, oh no, it's all homegrown, all home written. You know, we didn't license anything in. And I'm thinking, no, you know, I've got a whole file of licenses, you know, that you have used, and properly so. I wasn't concerned about what they had used, but I realized that they didn't understand that you know the value of this, you know, of the open source code that had been brought to bear in the development community. So with that, I became very interested in making sure that people were aware of, you know, the obligations they had to the open source developers who had made those tools available.
And also, I think, you know, one of the things I've heard you say before is also, you know, helping to educate other lawyers to see that same moment that you had when you were on the phone with that first developer in the math library, to understand that there's a, you know, that there's a real opportunity there, and that and to not be just frightened off of these licenses.
I have to say that my education, you know, took a long time. The light bulb flickered on and off and has continued to get, you know, brighter on these issues. I still have those moments when, you know, Richard Fontana, who's just like I think of as a national treasure, you know, will explain something and I'll say, "Oh, okay. Now, you know, now I get it." But there are, when we talk about there being two chasms that companies cross, and, you know, the first chasm is that they discover that they actually are using open source. They move from that, no, we don't do that, we don't use any of that, to the, oh my gosh, we do. And, you know, and it's managed as a problem. And then they cross that second chasm where they say this isn't a problem to manage, it's an opportunity to embrace. And, you know, when you get to that second, that crossing that second chasm, and you understand, you know, what the real value of that, you know, collaboratively developed and collaboratively maintained code is, you think about it very differently. And I've been fascinated recently, you know, to see some of the movement in, you know, the life sciences to adopt these same principles. And, you know, whereas in the open source community, sometimes you hear people talking about infrastructure, you know, that building infrastructure together and being codependent upon, you know, a certain infrastructure and sharing in the cost of maintaining that infrastructure, which provides a platform for everyone to innovate on top of it. In this life sciences area where they're beginning to talk about what they call pre-competitive phases. So, you know, they know that people are going to be really nervous about thinking about sharing everything, you know, in the competitive phase, but there's this long span of time, you know, prior to competition where there's development to be done and, once again, infrastructure to be built. And they're realizing that all of these concepts that were built by, you know, by these real visionaries in terms of the people who, you know, started this whole open source concept, the free software concept, you know, they're looking at that and saying all of those principles apply in these other industries as well. There's infrastructure that needs to be built, and no one company should or could build it alone. You know, and we need to understand that we're all dependent upon, you know, this shared infrastructure, and therefore we all have commitments to each other, you know, to maintain it and to honor the rules under which it was created.
So this is mostly one of the things we've talked a lot about educating our listeners who aren't from the legal community is the difference between inside and outside counsel. So it sounds like most of this advice that you've given in the past has been as outside counsel to these various companies that are adopting. And I'm curious to hear about your relationship with the Linux Foundation and whether, you know, you're more of an inside counsel role there or an outside counsel, because that's actually advising an organization that's well known in the open source and free software world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have been, so, you know, if I've had 30 years of my career, half of it was spent in-house and half of it was spent in firms. So I straddle those, you know, those two roles. Mm-hmm. In terms of the Linux Foundation, I think I'm probably closer to an in-house counsel in that role, and we can talk about the education. But when you talk about this difference between in-house and outside counsel, you know, there are many outside counsel that play a role that's very close to inside counsel. So I don't want to be mm-hmm. this isn't a sweeping generalization about the role that all lawyers play. But you know, for those companies that have crossed that second chasm and that have really embraced the opportunity of open source and realized their dependency upon the community, their review and analysis of these licenses is entirely different than a lawyer who's thinking about potentially litigating one of the licenses. You know, the judge for the company that participates in the community is the community itself. Is, you know, they're looking at whether the community will feel like you've really fulfilled your obligation to that community. And there's an enormous investment in the relationship in that community with these companies that have fully embraced and are dependent upon this, you know, this common code base. And so, you know, the idea that if we ever litigated it, it might be interpreted this way or that way, or, you know, that's mildly interesting, but the first order is, have we really met our obligation to the community? Because that's something I think about today, not whether it's going to get litigated years from now, but think about where I am today. And if I meet all of those communities' expectations regarding my participation, I'm not really that concerned that someone's going to, you know, make a claim against me that I'm going to end up litigating and that, you know, I'm worried that there'll be, you know, an interpretation by a judge in a court that
I'm really interested on that point of the communities that you're talking about, because one of the interesting things you're doing inside Linux Foundation is actually advising Linux developers, some of whom are actually employed. So I'm curious to hear about specifics of what kinds of things you're doing to help that community directly from within the Linux Foundation, hear a little bit more about that work. I think generally people are curious to hear more about what the Linux Foundation is doing in this legal and licensing area.
Well, we have, I mean, there's two layers to what we do. I mean, the foundation is, of course, made up of the members and the member companies, and those are, you know, those are these companies that are crossing the second chasm. And I work a lot with the member council on education projects, and we've, you know, we have talked among the three of us about how you know, in this particular field, that conversations among lawyers are very important in order to get you know, to share understanding. Some of it is because there's so much that, you know, that hasn't been litigated, and that it were you know, interpreting the license is more from these community expectations than from litigation, but also just in terms of common practices, best practices, compliance, and that's a big piece of what we do, is to try to make sure that there are lawyers that understand the way these things work, and that those lawyers are actively involved, not just in educating the other Linux Foundation members, but that are also actively involved in other conferences that lawyers attend in order to understand these matters better. Because these in-house lawyers that have worked at these companies that have fully embraced open source are among the most well-informed lawyers in these areas, you know, anywhere. A terrific example of that is Scott Peterson, who, you know, did the last podcast, or at least your first podcast. You know, he is an invaluable resource you know, to these other lawyers. In terms of the developers, they have, you know, they work very much in through the TAB, which is the Technical Advisory Board, and through James Bottomley and others, and it's generally James who will pose certain questions, and they are incredibly sophisticated already. I mean, they would, you know, people often, you know, wince a little bit at when there are conversations and people sign them, you know, IANAL, I am not a lawyer, but the depth of the analysis from someone like a James Bottomley, who's who is one of the Colonel Fellows, is tremendous, and the amount of history and the investment that he's made in fully understanding how these things work is enormous. So I, you know, I often learn as much from them as they would ever learn from me. They are individuals, and therefore, you know, I'm a counsel to the Linux Foundation. We're again in the mode of, you know, educating and raising issues, providing information, but I'm actually not an attorney for any of the kernel developers, nor could I ever be, nor do I represent, you know, the member companies that employ many of those developers. It's always in an education mode.
Sorry to interrupt, Karen. I thought maybe we should back up a second for our listeners, because I think many of them may not actually know the difference between different nonprofit organizations and how they're structured. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about here is a trade association, or you might hear it referred to as a 501c6, as opposed to a 501c3 or a charitable organization nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And the Linux Foundation is a trade association. And a trade association is governed by members that often pay dues, you know, and so it's a different style of basic governance. And so, I'm sorry, Bradley.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, if Karen on the phone, if you could talk a little bit about how it really basically how the trade association functions, mm-hmm. how its leadership and control works, I think that would be really helpful to our listeners, because our, you know, the hacker side of our listeners, because they're much more familiar with the 501c3 structure, which mm-hmm. is the most common for organizations they've known for many years, such as the Free Software Foundation. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk a little bit about how that structure works and how the leadership roles work from a legal perspective, I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah, that would be helpful, and also if we could hear how that ultimately ties together with the concept you were talking about earlier about companies working together, you know, to form community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because Karen had it all right, the other Karen, and of course, and the members, in the, what a trade association is about is identifying a common interest, a common, you know, set of goals. The companies may have very divergent goals as well, you know, outside of the foundation. They, you know, they may be competitors, they may be interested in very different things, but they have identified this one area in which their interests are aligned, and, you know, their support of Linux is a place where their interests are aligned. And in fact, I love the story of, you know, when the predecessor organization was the Open Source Development Labs, and that, and I'm sure it's a bit apocryphal, but it's a wonderful story anyway. You know, is that when they realized that there was a possibility, and maybe Linus would never have considered this, but you know, there was a possibility that one of the companies that ended up forming the membership, you know, might have tried to employ Linus. They all knew that that would be a very unfortunate thing to happen. That Linus's gift was his independence and his ability to work, you know, without any conflict caused by the desires of any particular company. That people had great confidence because he wasn't influenced by the interest of any particular company, and that there was actually a tremendous importance in keeping him, you know, objective and in keeping him separate. And so the Linux Foundation, or the predecessor organization, the Open Source Development Labs, Jim Zemlin will often say the most important thing we do is that we make sure that we can pay Linus's salary and health insurance, because that's the most important thing we do, is to provide a place for him to remain entirely separate and objective from the members. And we honor that.
That's great. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just for our listeners, Jim Zemlin is the CEO, right, mm-hmm. of the Linux Foundation?
Terrific.
That's his title. Just in case our listeners aren't aware. Sorry to interrupt.
Not at all.
I think you're absolutely...
You can keep me honest here.
It's interesting to hear about...
They should never fear that the Linux Foundation is in any way acting, you know, to interfere with those objective decisions that are made by, you know, Linus and Andrew. No one thinks that that would be, you know, a good idea.
And Ted Cho actually works there now too, right? He's also on the payroll recently.
Excuse me?
I think Ted Cho has also joined Linux.
What a gift.
That was a couple of months ago, I think.
What a gift to me. I mean, he is such a wonderful person to work with, and I've learned so much from him already.
I like Ted a lot. I've known him for a number of years. He's a great guy.
He's one of these people that are these wonderful, rare individuals, at least I find them rare, that is tremendously deep in his technical knowledge, but has an ability to explain it to non-technical people in ways that are just crystal clear, and has the patience of Job in doing so. Just amazing. So we don't have a lot of employees, though. That's often something that confuses people, and they think that we have lots and lots of employees. We actually have very few employees. I can't remember exactly what the number is, but it's very small, because the members the members sit as board members. They might host work groups. They might do various things, but they do all of those through their own employees. Or with respect to their relationship to the kernel, many of the people who work on the kernel may be employed but really operate with respect to the kernel as individuals. And we haven't changed any of those relationships or even tried to change any of those relationships or change the way, you know, the kernel works in terms of the development. You know, maybe a little bit around the edge, I think a few years ago they were trying to create some documentation around contributions, very, very little. And so the idea that the Linux Foundation has any direct influence over the kernel developers that's not right. We really don't. But we do have the members who have the resources to support things that the kernel developers want to do, and we see that as a very, very important part of our mission is to support them through, you know, hosting developer summits and getting them together so that they have an opportunity to meet and you know, work together. Again, hosting these work groups, and then we have the LSB, which is a certification that we're working on and that is supported by the Linux community. I think most of our technical work actually has to do with that certification work. And you could have Ted come on and talk at great length about the value of that testing. But mainly what we do is have, you know, the members get together, you know, generally at the board level, and decide that they will support and fund activities that are important to the developers and that advance, you know, the interests of the Linux ecosystem. Jim's as the CEO really sees his job as being a supporter of Linux adoption, you know, by customers. So anything that he can do to advance the interests of Linux users, is, you know, is within his, you know, within his scope of interest as the CEO of the Linux Foundation. But that doesn't mean that he intercedes in some way in development. It means that he, you know, he makes sure that customers have good answers to their questions, and that that we provide the response to some of the confusion that arises in the press, and that we do things that that help customers feel comfortable that that Linux is a terrific choice for them in terms of their technology needs.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the legal work that you're talking about you do inside the Linux Foundation is it really is different than a lot of the other legal work we've talked about with some of our previous guests, because you're saying you don't represent the industry partners who are the members of the trade association, and you don't represent the developers, and that most of your work is actually facilitation and education, which is a really interesting area of legal work that's not actually representing clients. So even though you are representing the Linux Foundation, your primary role in that is to act, it sounds like, as a facilitator and as an educator.
I am not the general counsel for the Linux Foundation. Andy Updegrove's firm serves that, mm-hmm. so they would be the representative in terms of corporate matters relating to the corporate mm-hmm. structure. And when Jim came to me and talked to me about coming on board, it was really very, very focused on education and collaboration among the in-house counsel. And it was important to him that, you know, that I had been in-house for so many years, and so that I had the freedom being at a firm, you know, to play that role, but that I had actually had an experience being in-house, and that I had had so many years of trying to educate myself, and that I knew how challenging it was to become educated when you didn't have someone like, you know, like you folks and like the in-house counsel at the Linux Foundation members, you know, sharing their experiences, because that's where the learning occurs, is really in that day-to-day, you know, use and working with the developers and in deploying the software.
What I think is so interesting is that you seem to, you know, it sounds like you get such an interesting look at so many different angles of the free software world, from interacting with the developers that are, I guess, contractors or otherwise employed at the Linux Foundation, or and also talking to your member companies, and I guess I was wondering if there were any particular issues that your members were concerned about. It must be fascinating to hear to talk to general counsels at all of the member companies and hear each of their different perspectives on the same issues.
It is, and I am just so grateful to have the opportunity to be in this position, because I learn something new every day. And you know, when I attend the collaboration summits or the developer summits, and I get to meet, you know, really some of the most impressive people I've ever met in my life that work on this. I mean, these are very, very thoughtful, dedicated people. It's a fascinating world, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to even participate in it. But you know, with respect to the, you know, to the members and others, you know, I feel I have followed this path of education for so many years. As I say, my light bulb didn't come on all of a sudden. It's my light bulb comes on a little bit every day. It's like, oh yeah, now I get that. You know, to meet other people who are on different places in that path, and you know, and to you know, to encourage them to you know, talk with someone or to read some material, or you know, where has that been discussed, or you know, what was the situation. I mean, I can never achieve the depth of experience that, you know, that some of you have been working with Eben and the Free Software Foundation will have, because you've had insights into, you know, so many different situations. But you know, having been doing this for a long time, there are a lot of different situations where when you explain, okay, this is what happened here. Oh, now that makes sense to me. When you can put it in a context. So, with respect to the companies, I go back to my chasms. you know, there are companies that are still sticking their toe in the water and are really uncomfortable, you know, in terms of they are not sure. I mean, the lawyers are not sure how conservative they're supposed to be about these things. They're not, you know, they're not exactly sure what everybody else is doing in terms of compliance programs. They're not exactly sure how everybody else is interpreting certain licenses. They're not exactly sure what people rely on and what they double check and what they don't check. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to bring them into an environment where they quickly get very comfortable. So I say, when we have our Linux Foundation Council meetings, the most important things that happen always happen in the side conversations, where people who are in similar positions in very different companies can talk to each other. And many times people have said to me, you know, at the end of a meeting, sometimes a meeting with other in-house counsel who aren't members, they'll say, you know, I feel so much better because I really felt like I was alone. I felt like everybody else had figured this out and I hadn't, or I felt like, oh, is somebody going to question me because I haven't taken a harder stance, or, you know, and now, you know, having been here, having talked with these people, I feel much more comfortable with where my company is, with how we're interpreting things, for where we're headed in terms of compliance. It's been a terrific experience to know that I'm not alone.
Yeah, certainly from somebody who's in like myself in the more radical side of the free software world, I've never been it's never been my strong suit of convincing for-profit companies to adopt free software. It's just never been my thing. But I'm really glad that there are people out there who are good at that, and I'm very grateful that you're doing that kind of work. Just to wrap up, you mentioned the Linux Collaboration Summit, and I didn't want to end without asking you about all the events that are going on this year. I noticed that Linux Foundation has a lot of events, more than I think in any other previous year. So I just wanted to ask if you wanted to mention a couple of those and tell people about them.
Oh, gee. Well, you know, I think it would take me a long time to describe them all, so maybe I'll just talk about them in general in terms of where we see ourselves, because I think Karen nailed it earlier to say we are really focused on education. And what we found in these first few years is that the response to these events was tremendous. And it isn't because we host the greatest party in the world. It's because we bring the some of the most interesting people together that are really focused on the development issues and on the advancement of the technology, and fascinating conversations occur. And as I said about one time, the first time I went, it was interesting to me that it was the first marketing-free zone I'd ever been in my life. You know, when you're with a company, there's always a little bit of the buzz and, you know, a little bit of the marketing and you're trying to sort of always promoting and you get the developers together and they have time for nothing but the truth. You know, they have no spin. They have, you know, they're not trying to put any lipstick on any pigs. They have time for nothing but the truth. And it is the most refreshing environment. It's very interesting. I think particularly in this time when we're all going back and really figuring out how to reestablish trust, you know, everybody ought to go to a Linux Developer Summit and see that you can deal with each other in complete honesty if the goal is just excellent, excellent code.
So our listeners can find out about the summits and other events on the Linux Foundation website?
Yeah, because there are many of them. I mean, I would slight somebody if I mentioned one and didn't mention another, but there are many events, and I think you'll see more and more events, some of them more narrowly tailored, some, you know, more focused on particular issues. And, you know, we'd really like to be supportive in bringing these people together who work so hard and facilitating the work that they do, and to facilitating more, you know, education among each other.
Well, Karen, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and this time is no exception. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was such an honor to be asked. I was humbled when you called and said that it might be worth your while. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, I think it was quite correct for me to say that the Karen Copenhaver does a job that I do not want to do. You know, because she doesn't actually work.
Wait, because she's a lawyer?
Oh, no, no, that part, well, I don't want to do that either. After working with you guys, it's made it clear that I don't want to go into billions of dollars of debt to go to law school or whatever it is you guys do. But aside from that, the job that I was talking about was so different from the work that the lawyers here do, which is representing hackers directly. She actually told us she doesn't do that.
Right, right, that she doesn't represent any of the Linux kernel developers directly.
And that her primary role is
Linux kernel.
Right, but her primary role is sort of interacting and educating these companies, which is, I agree completely, is a really important goal. It's just a goal that I never want to have the job of pursuing.
Well, I was smiling a little bit when she was talking about the experience of truth at a gathering of hackers, and I just thought, how lucky are we that that's sort of the experience we have so much of the time.
Yeah, I was sort of surprised that anybody puts up with situations where people are in marketing mode all the time, you know, and I would never go to a venue or event where that was the default, you know. This is why I don't like,
you know, like... Maybe that's a good reason to not become a lawyer.
I guess that's true. I mean, this is why I avoid things like the large, CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, and I used to hate Comdex. Oh, I used to go to run an FSF booth back in the old days, and man, Comdex is a horrible thing because it's all marketing hype and, you know, junk.
And we're not so much about marketing, but we are about answering our listeners' questions.
That's true. We're about giving good information to free software enthusiasts and hackers and supporters. So we don't get that many questions, so we want to give some attention to them. And in fact, when I read this question that we got, I felt like we've got to do a whole episode about this issue of license compatibility.
Well, I think you should summarize the question.
Yes,
first.
I should, but I'm letting people know that when we answer this question, we're just going to give a flavor, and we're going to plan a whole episode on this issue.
Oh, we are?
At some point in the future.
No, that sounds great. I think it merits its own.
I'm not promising when. I'm just saying it will happen.
It merits its own episode.
It will happen before I die, is all I'm saying.
Hopefully.
Sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the episode will come sooner, and yet you will still die later.
That's fine. But the point is, like, promising to do things before you die is a pretty easy proposition, because if you die, nobody can really do anything about it. But if you do it, then everybody's like, oh, he did say he was going to do it before he died. So, but we'll just give a brief flavor of these issues. This fellow named Matthew, and he hasn't said how he wants, actually, is Matt. He signs the message Matt, so we'll call him Matt. I don't want to say his last name because he didn't say we could, so we'll avoid doing that just in case he didn't want it known. But he's asking about starting a new project and selecting a license, but then having to worry about what libraries he's pulling from, what their licenses are. So he's asking about this issue of license compatibility, which is actually only a question of the free software world.
Yeah.
Because what happens in the corporate world, generally speaking, is you just negotiate a proprietary agreement to get the permissions you need, right?
Well, it depends, because I think there are some times when it depends. This is always the lawyer answer.
It's also the poker answer, by the way.
I think that there are some instances where you would just get a off-the-shelf license for something, and you would use it, and you would know that it fit into your uses, and that's another kind of, it's another flavor of license.
But even if it's off the shelf, you have enough money to go buy a license from the company that gave you.
Maybe
software.
You do and maybe you don't, but this issue does exist. Yeah,
there is a price, though. And in the free software world, there's usually not a price. You can't name an amount of money that you could get them to change the license because they picked their license. So the question is, when you start this new project and say, as Matt suggests, he wants to choose GPLv3, how does he figure out the complicated issue of license compatibility? Well, there's a couple of useful tools out there. One of them, our colleague at FSF, who was a previous guest, Brett Smith, wrote, which was the License Compatibility Matrix, which is on the FSF FAQ, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So that's a good resource to look at. But generally speaking, it's not as big of a problem as it seems at first. Go ahead.
I was just going to back up a little bit and say that sort of the principle behind it, and we were talking about this a little bit before in our last episode. Sort of the principle behind it is do the more restrictive licenses permit you to use the more permissive code that's contained, and are there conflicting restrictions?
Right, because when you build one big work, you have to be sure that you can meet the conditions of all the licenses in the whole work.
Right, all at once.
All at once, right. Yeah. But that's actually pretty easy. And GPLv3 was a help in this regard, because it added compatibility for example, the Apache 2.0, which was not compatible with GPLv2. Mm-hmm. So if you have a GPLv3 work and you want to include Apache 2.0 stuff inside it, that's fine. And also the useful fact that most people choose use the or later way of licensing under the various GPL and LGPL mm-hmm. variants. So if a project is GPL v2 or later, meaning they gave you permission to do it or to copy, modify, and distribute under v2 or v3 or v2 or later, you can incorporate that into a V3 work and right. make your whole work V3 or later, and you're fine.
It's like a label, but it's sort of like a meta licensing.
Yeah, it's actually, the license actually is V2 or later, and right. V2 is itself right. its own license and so forth, which mm-hmm. is an mm-hmm. issue we'll get into at
but
some later.
But if it is
later
or
day.
Later, then you're out of the woods.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And that's why it's a really good thing to do the or later. I mean, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to give the licensing
oh, this is a whole other podcast.
Control, you know, further. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. But the thing is you're basically, don't think of it in terms of I'm giving FSF the ability to decide. You're giving future incorporators of your work the ability to incorporate it.
Well, because, it's both things. You have to keep both in mind. Yeah.
You have to keep both in mind, yeah. but the important reason to do it is not necessarily just to get the new license. It's to mm-hmm. make sure that for perpetuity, because copyrights last so long that when new versions of the license come out, it works. So the only thing to really keep an eye out for are these GPL v2 only, LGPL v2 only works.
Right.
That's where the biggest incompatibilities come in.
And other licenses. And if there are licenses of like...
Truly oddball licenses, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few licenses that are incompatible, just generally speaking, with all the GPLs.
But luckily, the FSF has done a lot of the hard work
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and there's a list of what's compatible mm-hmm. and what's not. So you just reference that list usually, and it's pretty easy to figure out. And if you refer back to our previous episode, which I think was where this question stemmed from, Matt, our point there about making sure that you pick a license that's going to fit the community you're going to be in. So mm-hmm. it's important to survey the libraries you're going to use ahead of time and make sure you're picking a license. You know, if you're writing a plugin for Eclipse, you're probably going to want to choose the Eclipse license as part of your license structure, even if it's a mm-hmm. disjunction between Eclipse and GPL, so that you can be sure that you get included as part of Eclipse and your users can combine with Eclipse in the ways that they want.
And so that's an issue of community, and it's also an issue of compatibility. It's
right.
both.
Yeah, I think compatibility ultimately comes down to community issues most of the time, because
yeah.
you need to pick licenses
in
that
effect, it does,
work.
Yeah.
I just think that's true. It's not intuitive, but I think that's how it works.
Well, agreeing note.
Yeah. I hope that answers your question, Matt. And mm-hmm. if it doesn't, you can email us again. And if anybody else has questions they want us to address, podcast@softwarefreedom.org is the way to reach us.
And thanks for joining us.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks. Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.